the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the Church and the world. When we just say, just do it, just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. You know, it's, unfortunately, there is a lot of injustice in the world, and some of that injustice is a result of terror. Some of it is a result of extremism. And so it's kind of important that we kind of consider it. If we're going to try to make our world more just and more compassionate, we need to kind of look at some of the things that are really, really working against that. And we've heard about the situation where there's a lot of propaganda and social media tactics by ISIS and others who are trying to kind of sway Westerners to join ISIS ranks. And, you know, a lot of it, I think, has primarily been focused on young men. But there's also the issue of women. How do they relate to that? And some of those with whom they are partners are part of that. And so we're going to be exploring that today, and we're going to also speak about how we deal with situations of refugee children in situations in which kids become displaced from their natural home. So we're also going to be speaking about that issue and how some of the very, very important child welfare organization in New York, Children's Village, is helping the situation in Iraq by lending its expertise there. So a little bit later in the show, we're going to be speaking with David Collins, who is the Assistant Vice President for Programs and Policy at Children's Village. And our first guest in a little while will be Dr. Erin Marie Saltzman, who is a senior counter-extremism researcher at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. And, you know, that's one of those organizations, of which there are so many in the world, that have their own little niche in trying to help us to understand very complicated topics. So I'm delighted that in a few minutes we're going to be speaking with Dr. Erin Marie Saltzman. Tom, what's the news this week?
Well, certainly, Monsignor, I think one thing that we, you know, have to wind up remembering, you know, is significant anniversaries. And of course, we know that today is the 10th year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina kind of coming ashore in New Orleans. Category 3 storm when it hit. It was a Category 5 when it was in the Gulf of Mexico. In total, over 1,800 people were killed when that hurricane hit. In total in the United States, over 1,500 in Louisiana alone. And, you know, it's funny, but the population of New Orleans prior to when Katrina hit was up around almost 500,000 people, Monsignor. And even today, 10 years later, roughly the population has, some have come back. The population is back really at just about 80% of what it was on pre-Katrina levels. And I just think we have to just remember those folks, remember some of the suffering that they had gone through, remember some of the, you know, tragedy that our nation experienced at that time, and just hopefully some of the lessons we learned from that terrible storm.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Part of the crisis that our world is facing these days is the crisis of migrants. And many of those migrants are refugees who are fleeing very, very clear and overt persecution. Many of those who are migrating are immigrants who are seeking refuge from extreme poverty. And that is a significant number of people in the world today, whether it be within a country or across borders. Those are in the 40, 50 million numbers. The other type of migration, which is also huge, is from natural disasters, that oftentimes there are reality of millions upon millions of people who are displaced because of hurricanes, because of typhoons, things of that nature. And I think it's good for our listeners in the United States to realize that first of all, two things. One, that disasters are not things that the United States is exempt from. And so that's one of the things we need to realize. And the natural hurricane disaster of Katrina 10 years ago was devastating for the Gulf Coast, and particularly the sister city of New Orleans. As kind of Tom mentioned, you know, there were 500,000 people in that city. And then afterwards, I think the population went down to almost half of that. And now it's built up to about, as Tom said, about 80% of what it was pre-Katrina. So there are a lot of disasters, a lot of refugees in the world. But I also think, as you know, people of the United States, it's significant and it's always important to realize that when things happen close to home and how we respond, which I'll talk about in a moment, the reality is that disasters and crises in other parts of the world, in the sheer magnitude of them, is just so much greater. And sometimes, you know, we get a little bit caught up in our own problems and we don't realize the rest of the world. So it's good for us to think about Katrina and what happened in New Orleans, but also to remember that, you know, for many ways, for so many reasons, the United States is a blessed country in dealing with disasters, but disasters that are relatively modest in terms of the quantity of damage and the number of life compared with people in the world. When they hit, they're devastating. I don't mean anything, take anything away with that. You know, almost 2,000 people killed is just horrendous. But some of those things the rest of the world deals with not as a 10-year event, but they deal with it, you know, ongoing, periodic, you know, in a very, very much more regular place. And we need to recognize that too. But one of the things, Tom, I do want to mention for our listeners is in the aftermath of Katrina, once more, the church was one of those organizations that was at the forefront in trying to deal with the damage that went there. Catholic Charities in New Orleans was just so present to the people there trying to help with the immediate kind of response and the alleviation of suffering in the days and weeks right after that devastation, but then in a variety of other ways to help rebuild the city. And one of the areas that the Catholic Church was so instrumental in was getting up and started within, no, not immediately, but in a relatively short period of time, an education system. Now, it completely changed from the number of schools and the way it was organized prior to Katrina, but it said, "Hey, if we get these schools up and running, then people will come back and rebuild their lives." And so, again, an absolutely awful disaster, tragic, almost 2,000 people killed. Once more, in that tragic situation, the church and its education system and Catholic Charities was instrumental in helping that community to rebuild. I know that we, even in Catholic Charities in New York, we sent down a number of social workers to spend a period of time there helping those who were the victims there. And I, you know, people don't think about this, but we actually sent them to Houston because when people were displaced from New Orleans, they went to the neighboring states and a fair number had come in Houston. So we supported Catholic Charities in Houston in trying to help those people who were there.
Wow, and that's true, Monsieur. I didn't think of the broader context, but that makes a lot of sense.
So let's go to our first guest, Director Erin Marine Saltzman, who is the senior counter-extremism researcher for the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. Dr. Saltzman, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Great. Just tell our listeners a little bit about what the Institute for Strategic Dialogue is about.
Well, ISD is a somewhat unique think and do tank. So actually, any research that we do is very action-oriented and feeds into some of the different projects that we run, which are really tailored around trying to counter violent extremism of all different kinds. So we look at Islamist extremism, we look at far-right extremism, we really look at hate-based violence. And so some of the things that I do there, I run our Women and Extremism Network, which looks at what draws women into violent extremist networks, but also looks at how women can be further advanced in the countering extremism sector as activists, as practitioners. And I also run our Youth Civil Activism Network. So we have a network across Europe, currently just across Europe, but expanding more internationally, which tries to get young people involved in counter-extremism efforts in safe and secure ways. So it's no easy task, really.
Well, I'm glad you're doing it, and I'm glad that you're making a contribution to kind of trying to make the world a better place. So, but, you know, obviously there's a lot being written these days on extremism, et cetera, and on almost any topic that comes up contemporarily. My own thought is it really all that new, or is it just we're reporting on it more, and therefore with all of the media stuff, you know, it's not much different than it was, you know, 50, 60 years ago. It's just we know about it. What's your sense of what's going on with extremism in the world?
Well, obviously, violent extremism is not new. We've seen holocausts. We've seen horrible violence that's hate-based violence. We've seen the crisis right now is really about ISIS or ISIL. But we've seen jihadist movements in the past, like Al-Qaeda. The difference now is kind of twofold. When we look at something like ISIS, we actually see it's kind of a game changer in two main respects. One is that you have a group that has actually declared its own territory. So a violent extremist group that has done what all the other extremist groups said that they wanted to do as a goal. So
now, Dr. Salzman, let me clarify for our listeners who probably don't follow this on a day-to-day basis.
Well, of course.
Is that one of the issues that kind of nobody can quite figure out? Why some people say ISIS, why the president seems always to want to say ISIL, and is this part of the issue of claiming territory and being a state and those type of things? Is that what kind of that little bit of a debate is about?
The name debate is, well, it's partially because we're dealing with a Middle Eastern group where the direct translation into English is imperfect. So part of it's kind of just logistics. But when you say ISIS or ISIL or Daesh, as some people call it, you're talking about the exact same group. The actual difference is that America did not go with ISIS. They went with ISIL more so, also because a lot of stores and small businesses already are called ISIS after the Egyptian goddess. So actually, it was really it was poor to call this terrorist group ISIS for an American context. So it's kind of just it's less about real terms. It's more the politics. But also, some people have a real problem with calling it the Islamic State because it seems like it's recognizing, one, that it represents Islam, and two, that it's an actual state. And actually, we'd say most people that would say that they're Muslim want nothing to do with this group, and also nobody internationally recognizes it as a legitimate state. So that's a real problem from the get-go.
Okay.
But terms are imperfect.
Right. So again, repeat that point, because I cut you off when you were talking about the game changer being that territorial issue.
So why that's a game changer for them to declare that this is a state is it kind of fulfills all these fantasies of the extremist ideology, which just like other horrible violent extremist groups from the past, such as, let's say, the Nazis with Hitler's Nazi group, they wanted to create this utopian area that they controlled. And ISIS is no different in that respect. However, to declare this state is very symbolic, especially for trying to recruit other people to go to one territory. So in the past, we've had foreign fighters join Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, but it was a round trip ticket. You'd go out and you'd participate in jihad, and then you'd go back or you'd go to another territory. This is a one-way ticket for recruits. They're telling them that they are coming to create a utopian society. And the second thing that's very different is really that this is a modern terrorist organization, and they allow for their supporters to be modern online digital people. So what that means is they are allowing foreign fighters to tweet, and they're allowing the brides of the jihadists to tweet and engage online. And that's very dangerous as well, because what it does is, for if you're being recruited, to be able to talk directly with somebody on the ground that's already living there, that they can give you, they can answer all your questions and answers. It means that you feel much more comfortable. It's no longer, when you think of a jihadist, it's no longer wrapped in an air of mystery. You feel like they're very human and they're very easy to talk to.
And I assume that, like, that, you know, it's almost, not to quiver, but it's, if somebody's going to college in a different part of the world, they can Skype home and they talk with their family. This is almost that same type of, well, I would say, intimacy in terms of a recruiter is talking one-on-one with somebody, you know, thousands of miles away.
It is. It's creating a whole new level of intimacy. And it's also speeding up that process of radicalization. So it's hard because you also, it's very quick to judge the internet as well. So I deal a lot with online extremism. And it's quick to say, well, just get them all offline. But it's actually not very easy to do. We see a lot of accounts being taken down constantly that almost instantly reappear and are able to regain their followers. But also, the more that main online platforms like Facebook or Twitter, the more that they censor these accounts, we see this migration of that conversation taking place online to move into smaller pockets of the internet that are harder to monitor and less easy to survey. So it actually, you kind of play a cat and mouse game when you rely on censorship. So we really think you need to openly counter it. You have to have initiatives and campaigns and get credible voices to stop that process of radicalization before it gets to that point.
I mean, we're speaking with Dr. Erin Marie Salzman, who is a senior counter-extremism researcher for the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. But she's not only a researcher, she's a doer. In fact, if I would say she probably belongs in more the ops research area than simply academic research, because it's got trying to affect positively the issues of extremism and terrorism and violence that we're experiencing in the world. So we're glad that Dr. Salzman is with us. You know, Dr. Salzman, two areas that you mentioned that you have a particular kind of attention to, I think would be interesting for you to talk a little bit about women, because I think, you know, traditionally, you know, it's almost by exception that you realize how things are so weighted in one direction. I mean, the fact that in the United States they celebrated within the past week that two women became the highest level, I think, of Army Rangers in this country, and it kind of made a media splash, is just the indication about how much fighting, wars, things like that was thought to be a man's job. And I think, you know, again, having said that, I think when people think of ISIS, when they think of terrorists, when they think of extreme violence, I think they oftentimes think of men. And maybe it's because it is an overwhelming majority of men. But I'd like to hear what you've been doing in terms of women, where they fit in, how that is a piece that explains some of what's going on.
So one of the things that we do is we actually run the largest known database that tracks Western women that have gone to migrate to ISIS territory, so Western women that have joined ISIS that are now living there. And we track them through social media profiles, all of their online discourse. We archive it constantly because these accounts are taken down and reappear. And we also map out all the different data that we know about them. We share this database. We work in parallel to a male foreign fighter database. So actually, we can find out quite a lot when they get married. We know who their husbands are. We try to work out what is their age, where are they coming from, socioeconomic backgrounds, education levels. So we have a huge amount of data about who are these Western women joining ISIS. And what's interesting for me is when I read a lot of media, you hear the talk around these men, the man foreign fighters, and the words that come up often are angry, violent young men. And when you hear about the women that join, you often hear a very different rhetoric where people talk about being naive and sexually groomed and brainwashed. And what we find actually is that you could equally say that a lot of these young men have been brainwashed or naive. And a lot of these women are equally angry and violent. And so we do kind of have to move beyond the gender stereotypes, because actually when we look at every terrorist organization or violent extremist organization, whether that's Nazis, whether that's the Irish resistance movement, whether that's Al-Qaeda, they've all used women and had women joining, whether that's as a fighter or as logistics or to be able to smuggle weapons. And
hey, Dr. Salzman,
really significant.
Let me ask you as a researcher, and that's mm-hmm. fascinating, and if you're kind of running your crosstabs, if you categorized like men into quote-unquote angry and naive, you'd get a certain percentage that you would say were angry, certain naive. If you categorize your women into angry and naive, do your crosstabs equal each other, or do you get a little bit of a different proportion into each of those categories?
I think that actually when you look at the women, we see a surprisingly maybe higher number of women that are quite educated, or if they're undereducated, it's probably because they're quite young. But a lot of the women that we've been tracking got really high grades before they decided to join. They were seen as very intelligent. Not all of them, but a lot of them. Actually, we've seen women that have doctorate degrees that have gone over. And there's not really one distinct profile, because the women in our database alone, and we have over 130 women in our database that we track, they range in age from 14 all the way to 45. Mm-hmm. Some of them were married before they went out. Some of them went there. A lot of them went there specifically as single and are now married to jihadist fighters.
Now, do you know how many, just again for comparison, do you know how many would be in kind of the male database?
So a lot more men have gone over. The rough estimates, and they're not as updated as they should be, but the rough estimates when you look at the West, we know that over 4,000 men have gone. It's probably a bit larger than that from the West alone. Right. Of that, we know of over 550 women at least that have gone from the West. So you're looking at roughly 10 to 25% of all the people going out there are actually women.
Okay, so that's a not.
That's quite high, actually.
Yeah, let me say it positively. I mean, that is a significant percentage of that, and I think you're right. I think that people would think that is probably higher than most people would say. And again, obviously, you have different people going for different reasons. Some of those would be as kind of spouses, partners of men who are there?
We do have some women that were already married and already very extreme before they went over. But a large part of this group are not. And actually, one of the things we do is kind of try to track their reasons for going over there. Because it's quite hard for most people. It's quite shocking. And it's quite hard to understand why you would leave the comforts of a Western society to move to the middle of a desert and join a terrorist organization is quite shocking to us. But actually, we see a lot of grievances that kind of prime you to be vulnerable to this sort of radicalization. That includes feeling isolated, like maybe you don't belong within your community. That includes feeling disappointed with foreign politics and disappointment with what's going on in a region and the sense that the Muslim community is being persecuted internationally. But also, that alone doesn't make you buy a ticket to Syria. So
Dr. Salzman, let me ask you. So if you took the 500 women or even the 4,000, well, let's just stick with the women for a moment. Would many of them have some Muslim connection? Would all of them? Would they have relatives or friends, or would they simply out of the blue decide this is where they want to go?
Well, a lot, probably a majority, are from second or third generation immigrant families that have Muslim connections of some sort that they would identify as being Muslim. However, per capita, there's actually a high number of converts. So individuals that actually were not raised with any identity that related to Islam or being Muslim that were radicalized and recruited through other ways.
And again, what you indicated for people in general, I assume, is also very clear there. That group might have a sense of isolation, sense of grievances, that they're not fitting in the West, and therefore this becomes something that they're attracted to?
Well, definitely, and actually especially for women, because we know that, unfortunately, Muslim women receive a larger amount of abuse, either verbally or even physically, in the streets, just in public, compared to men, especially if they happen to wear a headscarf, whether that's, you know, the headscarf that just covers the hair, or whether it's a larger veil or outfit. They receive a lot more abuse because they are physically identified as being Muslim. So most often that type of abuse is somebody either trying to tear off their headscarf or actually being spat at. So you can imagine, as a Muslim female, that is more part of your grievance, perhaps, of feeling like, even if you think of yourself as a Muslim American or a Muslim British person or a Muslim French person, you're not allowed to feel like you truly belong.
Now, Dr. Salzman, I thank you for your time. We have a few minutes left. Since, obviously, I think part of the thing is, how do we prevent this from happening? And you mentioned taking down websites is probably not as important as doing positive things. So what are some of the things either you or the center is doing or others are doing to try to prevent this from happening?
Well, one of the things that we do is we try to upscale the efforts of credible voices, people that are credible within the community, people that can provide an alternative narrative. We work a lot with a lot of interfaith community groups, actually, people that bring together different faiths to show that violence or hatred is not part of any of these religions. We work a lot with spiritual leaders, but as well as working with young people that have a stakehold within their own communities to try to get that alternative voice heard. Because the problem why extremists win is that you have this extremist minority, but they are monopolizing the discourse around some key topical questions for young people, like what is going on in Syria? Why is the Assad government still in power? Big questions, but the only people answering them sound to be large, loud extremist voices. So to get that alternative voice is important.
Hey, let me ask you a broader question, but which is, since you deal with this all the time, I wonder if, and not merely relating to this issue of terrorism, extremism, with regard to Islam and ISIS, but is the existence of social media and the way that it's work permits such niche kind of marketing that this extreme stuff is, in a sense, easier to get out than when you had a homogenous kind of media in which there was far fewer outlets and kind of there was a least common denominator thing that got broad through? Is part of the ability for this to kind of work the fact that the whole way we communicate in the media has changed?
The social media, we're definitely witnessing a digital generation gap where, yes, social media as a tool has facilitated the upscaling of these types of voices. What I am hopeful about is actually if you look at propaganda, marketing, the idea of spreading an idea, we have many more positive actors that could be involved online to scale up that moderate voice that we're not really seeing as much right now. Extremists will always use what tools are available to them, just like anyone else, but you wouldn't blame the pen for writing Mein Kampf. So you can't really blame the internet for the existence of ISIS, but we need to work with the tools in just as well a way as the extremists are. We need to beat them at that game a little bit better.
But at the other hand, I would either blame or credit the printing press for the greater availability of printed material, whether it be good printed material or bad printed material.
That is an argument to be made. But the point is, what we're trying to work on is get young people to a point where we can educate them so that even if they see that material, they're not allured by it.
Right.
So even if you came across that, you are already resilient to it. And that's the resilience and teaching those types of acceptance and resilience is really the key.
Hey, Dr. Salzman, thanks so much for giving us so much of your valuable time. I know I learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners learned a lot. And please, keep up the good work you're doing, because sometimes there are such bad things going on in our world, and everybody needs to kind of do their part. So thanks so much for spending time, and thank you for the work that you do.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Dr. Erin Marie Salzman, who is the Senior Counterterrorism Researcher at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, and looks at what can be done, what's going on in the world of extremism, and how there can be positive impact on that to prevent some of that extremism from taking root and turning into violence. We're going to take a break now. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. And our world will be more just. It will be more compassionate. Join us when we come back in just a minute or two on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church in the world. Just love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. This week, we're speaking about things which unfortunately make our world less just, certainly less compassionate. We're speaking about extremism in the world. We're speaking about terrorism. We're speaking about ISIS, and we're speaking about refugees in Iraq, and it's a situation which is very, very difficult. It is a very unjust situation in so many ways, clearly a lack of compassion. And in a few minutes, we're going to speak with somebody who has been trying to do his part to make that place better, David Collins, who is Assistant Vice President at Children's Village, which is a very wonderful organization in New York that has helped children for a century. And he's been over in Baghdad trying to help some of the children's organizations there to create places when children are refugees where they're treated with compassion, where they help to kind of continue their lives in a way which doesn't disrupt them any more then the fact of them being a refugee or an displaced person has already done that. So we'll speak with him a little bit later on in the show. Tom, anything else new?
Yeah, you know, Monsignor, one of the things we were talking about refugees, we were talking about migrants and such, and you know, just this past week, it was announced that from the Vatican that the theme for the 102nd World a Day of Migrants and Refugees has been chosen, and it's called Migrants and Refugees Challenge Us. The response of the gospel is mercy. And the reason I think that there's
been... Tom, I hate to, you know, I know it's from the Vatican, I think. Angie, you excited by that message? You excited by it? You gonna run out and buy the message?
Do you want the truth?
Of course.
Always.
I might.
Oh, you might? Oh, that was a good answer.
Tom is convincing me.
Well, all right, Tom. We'll see if you can convince Angie
that
this is something that she should know about.
Well, I think you should, Angie, because, you know, one of the things I think, one of the reasons that I think that...
And if you can convince Angie, then Angie's got to convince me.
Oh, okay. Very good. Very good. I think is, and one of the reasons I think why the Holy Father has been, Pope Francis has been constantly at this, is because we are currently suffering underneath a terrible refugee crisis.
I want to go on record. I'm not against Pope Francis. I'm against documents and statements.
Okay. And he and you know and what he and I think what the statement is trying to bring out is that that according to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, which analyzes these things for the United Nations, we're going through what they claim.
That's a job I want. Wouldn't that be nice, Angie? Wouldn't you like that to be the United Nations High Commissioner? On anything.
That sounds very nice.
Yeah. I mean, given
not the low commissioner, but the high.
I want to be the high commissioner,
not the medium one. No, I want to
be
the high one.
I want to be the high commissioner.
I want to be top dog.
But you know what I want to be high commissioner of?
Tell me.
Ice cream.
I knew you were going to say ice cream. Yes. Yep. We talk about ice cream every time.
Did you get?
Here.
Do you have any? Right. Did you have any vanilla ice cream in the past week?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I did.
Was it good?
It was very good.
Good. Okay, that's good. But the other thing we got to check out is, have you registered to vote yet? Because you're displaced from Austin, Texas to New York.
That's right.
Have you registered to vote yet?
No. I was so worried that you were going to ask me today.
Well.
The week goes by. I have one more week, though.
Good. Yes.
Just be certain. I'm going to ask you next week.
I know.
So be worried, but be registered, and then you don't have to worry.
Exactly. Yes. Okay. For the first 30 minutes of the show, you didn't ask me. And I was thinking, he forgot.
No.
Monsignor never forgets.
Nope. No. And then you look at me and then you asked and I just knew.
Yep.
Dang it.
Yep. So anyway, so Tom, seriously.
Seriously.
I always kind of make fun of documents because I got to confess, as important as they are, they sometimes don't grab me in kind of the stuff. So come on, convince Angie why this one is particularly valuable.
This one is important, Monsignor, because as the UN has said, that we are going through the largest refugee crisis really since the Second World War, that currently there are 59.5 million people who've been forcibly displaced from their homes worldwide. That includes both 19.5 million refugees, who are people who have left their home country to enter into the territory of another country. And that also includes 1.8 million people seeking asylum. And this is, I think, Monsignor, you made reference to this earlier in the show with folks who, let's say, left New Orleans to go over to Houston. Internally displaced persons, which there are almost 39 million internally displaced persons around the world. So what we're witnessing is so many people on the move that I think it becomes really a critical issue for us, as I think as Christians, as Catholics, certainly, to be cognizant and to be challenged by that issue and what we're going to do to help those people who I think are on the move.
I think you're right. And I think one of the things, to be very serious for the moment, one of the things I really concerns me about our kind of declaration of National Migration Week and stuff like that, it's one of those things which is critically important. But the reason why I kind of joke about it a little bit is nobody pays attention to it. Angie, I bet you didn't even know there was a National Migration Week.
I did not know about the National Migration Week.
Right, right. And so do a lot of people. Now, again, so I think some of the things we got to do as a church is we got to make sure that people are aware of these things and people are really on top of them in the sense of knowing about it. And I think it's not that difficult. We got to spend some energy doing it because everybody does know, particularly the issue of immigration being such a critical issue in this country. So people get it that people move, and then we got to figure out how we reflect on it from our Catholic values, our Catholic Christian perspective. And I'm just going to say a couple of things. I mean, one is the fact that we do recognize as a church, one of our values is that people do have a right to migrate from one country to another for a just cause, that they do have the right to do it. And extreme poverty can be a really just cause because if people can't provide food, they can't provide shelter, they can't work, to migrate to find that is certainly a legitimate reason to do it. At the same time, part of our church teaching is that countries do have a right and even a responsibility to some extent to secure their borders, to make sure that there is an orderly way that people can come in. So what we get into a little bit of a debate is to saying, well, okay, we need people can migrate if they need a job someplace else, and a country can secure the border. So the issue is, well, how many people do we let in? And what's the conditions on which they come in? And that's the debate we have. I have to tell you, a little bit of a complaint that I have, my little complaint that I have is that that's the issue. The issue is how many, what conditions, what do we do to treat people humanely? What do we do to make sure there's an orderly process? And that's what we're debating about. But it gets so angry and people get so, you know, build a fence or, you know, deport them all or like, you know, the border should just be completely open. Well, no. Our values say, yes, we respect a country and its ability to deal with its borders, to secure its borders. But every country, especially those who have more resources, have the responsibility to have a generous immigration policy so that people can migrate for a good reason. So, and we're going to talk more about that. We're going to talk more about that in future weeks. I want to save some time for our next guest, who is David Collins, but we're going to take a break. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back in 2 minutes on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world. So just love. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, love yourself. And for this part of our show, I'm delighted to speak with David Collins, who is at Children's Village. And Children's Village is just one of those wonderful organizations in the New York metropolitan area that for century or more has been helping children who have been in very difficult situations. And so I'm delighted that we're going to speak with David Collins, who has been a major player in helping children in New York. But we're going to speak specifically about what he's been doing in Iraq and some of the expertise that he has lent over there. David, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on Just Love.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for that very kind introduction.
Well, it's well-deserved. I know you spent time in the New York City child welfare system, and I know you've spent time at Children's Village, and we could spend hours talking about that. But in the time we have here, I would just love for you to tell me about Iraq and what's Children's Village doing there and your own kind of observations, because you've been there a few times in the past period, right?
That's true. I've been there five times since 2009.
Wow.
Children's Village was approached in 2009 by a newly founded Washington, D.C.-based foundation, which is now known as the Iraqi Children Foundation. It was made up of people who had experience in Iraq during and after the most recent war, including veterans as well as, you know, people from State Department, people who'd been in diplomatic roles and who had witnessed, you know, the way that children and orphans were suffering in Iraq in the aftermath of the invasion.
You know, let me interrupt you, David, just
for a
second to say, one of my classmates who has been a military chaplain, actually a Navy chaplain for a number of years, every now and then, he just drops in the midst of conversation, oh, how he's been to this program in this part of the world, and how he's helping in this area. It is amazing to me the underreporting of how much good individual government people do because they've experienced something. And then on their own, they take the initiative to try to deal with that, not necessarily from a governmental point of view, but as private citizens trying to make the world a better place. So thanks for pointing that out. I'm always impressed by that.
That's absolutely true. I've met a lot of people from state or from other diplomatic roles, and you pretty much never meet anyone in those positions who's not, you know, doing something in their free time, which they generally have very little of.
Okay, so now tell us about, so you got involved with the Iraqi Children Foundation.
Right, we were approached by them, you know, so they had been doing direct aid in Baghdad. They started out very hand-to-mouth, just, you know, like literally pulling together donations and going out and doing what they could, and they were encountering people who were suffering, you know, in tremendous ways, who'd experienced a lot of trauma, who'd, you know, been victims of conflict, been victims of things that are really hard to imagine or talk about, and so they were looking for an organization in the United States that could help them, you know, deal with those issues and help other Iraqis who were working, you know, with these families deal with the trauma concerns and the mental health concerns that come with, you know, being a victim of ongoing conflict. And so they brought us in, and we made our first trip there in 2009 as a guest of the Iraqi government. We conducted a needs assessment there, and as well as a kind of basic training on child development and trauma with a group of non-government organizations as well as Iraqi government employees. And from there, we've just kind of tried to maintain that relationship and expand those efforts, which has often been a challenge just due to the security situation there. But we're kind of continuing to stay engaged and trying to, you know, provide support to these organizations that are doing very difficult work under very dangerous circumstances in Iraq.
Now, David, you obviously are very familiar with the kind of the system where we deal with kids who are in very difficult situations, abuse, neglect in this country, and you kind of deal with the situation where there's a report of abuse, and then it's investigated, and then if it appears to be serious, the child might then be placed in a foster home for a while, and maybe for a year or two, and hopefully they go back to their own families in a brief period of time. Sometimes they're adopted, and sometimes they're there for a while. So that's the system that, you know, we kind of know in this country. I imagine it's quite different dealing with troubled or abused or orphaned children in Iraq.
It is. It's very different. And, you know, as you would imagine, because of the conflict there, because of all the disruption to civil society and to government in that country, really over the last 30 years, a lot of the institutions that they would have had have been damaged or withered away completely. So, one big difference is that there's really there's very little government-run foster care in Iraq when children are either abused or when they're actually orphaned. And, I was a foster care director here in New York concurrent with some of my visits to Iraq, and so I'm no stranger to pretty bad situations in families, unfortunately. And the stories that you hear in Iraq, really are very shocking in terms of the level of suffering. And they're dealing with more complex and more challenging issues there with far fewer resources than what we have here. One of the big kind of structural barriers they have is that there's actually a constitutional amendment that prohibits non-government organizations like the Children's Village in the United States or like many of the member organizations of Catholic Charities from providing out-of-home care for children. This was a law that was enacted because of concerns over human trafficking, but it's been in place for a long time. But because of now the current situation, it's left their infrastructure in a really rough place in terms of their ability to deal with this huge flood of children that have been orphaned or have been traumatized.
I know numbers are hard to compare and things like that, but how many kids are in the situation where it's not safe or they can't be cared for by their own families? What's your estimate?
Well, it's much more common in Iraq that children would be in under the care of the government because they literally don't have families, or
right,
because the families are so destitute that they can't care for them. Whereas here, usually it's a removal due to actually an allegation of maltreatment. But
right,
roughly speaking, Iraq is a country of 30 million people. We think there were about 800,000 orphans in Iraq before this most recent wave of violence, and that means just for comparison's sake, in the United States we have less than 500,000 children in foster care, and our country, our population is more than 10 times the size of Iraq.
So let me,
that's a huge number of children relative to the size of the population.
Again, let me bring it down a little bit. So if you got 30 million people, that means what are we talking about? Maybe 15 million children?
The population skews very young there because of all the conflict. I mean, they've essentially been at war for the last 30 years.
So,
between Iran, Iraq, and then the two Gulf Wars and the sanctions and the sectarian violence.
From
the population.
Yeah, obviously, from my perspective, obviously this is a gross estimate, but it might be as much as maybe 1 in 15 kids or something.
Yeah, or more than that even. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, those 800,000 are the ones that are, completely orphaned. Virtually everyone you meet in Iraq, has a family member or a neighbor who's been impacted by violence or has been murdered. Almost everybody has witnessed, a violent crime or heard of one and been affected by one. So those are, it's really, there's a level of collective trauma in the country, even above and beyond the individual trauma that children experience, that colors everything that happens and that impacts the work that people in the NGO sector are doing, because this is their trauma as well. They're not separate from it. They're living it as well.
So the 800,000, are they in camps or are they, where are they?
Well, we don't have great data on it. And unfortunately,
right,
Iraq is somewhat isolated from the international aid community because the security situation is so bad. Very few children are in government-run facilities. The number that I heard is 1% or less.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of them are they're in the street. Some of them are literally living in dumps, or they're falling into exploitive situations like human trafficking or terrorism. They're being recruited into criminal gangs. So really, right now, we're reaching very few of those children.
Wow. So again, the expertise that you've had in a variety of things, were you feel that you were able to offer any advice that actually helped things, that made things a little bit better? What would one or two of those things be?
I think we were, and it was a very humbling experience because people were bringing these scenarios to me and I was overwhelmed by it. And I would try my best to give some kind of concrete examples of things that they could do. One of the first things that we do with our employees here is just help them frame trauma and understand what it means and how it impacts child development, and to start to normalize some of the challenging behaviors that you see from traumatized children, so that you aren't, you know, so that you're not frustrated by it. So a lot of caregivers in Iraq, you know, in addition to all the other things they have to worry about, they're dealing with children who are, you know, having real emotional problems because of what they've experienced. And so the first thing we do is try to teach employees and volunteers and, you know, families about why they're seeing what they're seeing from their children and what are some very concrete strategies in terms of how they communicate with them, how they manage their day-to-day routine that can help them regulate themselves emotionally a little better. And people there responded to that really well. And we found that when we delivered the training on that and some of those specific tools and then came back several years later, we found people still using them, still using the materials that we had given them, even without having organizations that were backing them or you know, sponsoring the work. They were still going out and doing it. So that was really inspiring and heartening to see that they had taken those things and run with them.
David, we have about a minute left. If there's one kind of one reality or one fact or one piece of information that you'd like our listeners to know about the situation of the children in Iraq, what would that be?
Well, I would just say that people in the U.S. probably don't know that people in Iraq just want the same thing that everybody else wants. They want peace. They're desperate for a functional government. And they absolutely have the ability and the desire to rebuild their country. And they just need peace and security in order to do that. So I'm really hoping that, you know, that somehow we can find a way to stabilize the situation there, because there's some wonderful people in that country and they want to rebuild it.
Hey, David Collins, thank you so much for giving your time. David is the vice president, one of the vice presidents at Children's Village. David, thanks for taking the time to be with us, and give my best to Jeremy. He's just a wonderful leader up there.
I certainly will. Thanks again for having me.
Okay. So, Angie, you got a job for the next week, right?
Yes, I do.
And what is that job?
Register to vote in New York.
Yay. That's good. That's good. And you know, we're not going to tell you who to vote for. All we're going to do is tell you that you have to vote.
Oh, for sure.
Okay. That's a very, very important thing. Do you know it's abysmal? It's abysmal, the number of people who vote.
Really? Oh. I didn't know that. I always grew up knowing I had to vote.
Yep. Well, it's a good thing. It's part of a citizen's responsibility, but so few people vote, sometimes as low as 25% in an election. Anyway, This is Just Love, our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just do it. Love God, love your neighbor, and love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back next week on Just Love on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.